You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
And good morning, everyone. My name's Kevin Jackson. Thank you for being here. West Hill is a place where we are all not just encouraged, but challenged to seek our own truths on our own spiritual journeys and to incorporate those into our own faith model, which includes our own beliefs, and to be open-minded enough to revisit those if new truths lead you to that. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations.
Many of you know that on Tuesday, members of the First Nations Study Group took our petition to the presbytery to share it with the presbytery, and they were invited to do that by the Justice and Global Issues group. And so they did, and they presented beautifully, and I have that on recording if anybody wants to listen to what they said. And I had asked people last week to take our petition and go to other congregations, and I know of at least one congregation that is getting petition bombed this morning, and that is Lawrence Park Community Church. So two members of the congregation are there sharing the petition and inviting them to sign it. But also at that presbytery, we challenged other congregations to take up the responsibility of reading the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommendations over the course of the next 94 weeks. And College Street United Church is going to do that. So they are starting on July 2nd. The minister phoned me and said, I am ashamed that I do not know anything about this. I do not know enough. I don't know enough about reconciliation. I don't know enough about Indigenous issues. And so he and his congregation are going to begin that exploration. I thought that was a great opportunity for us to have shared our work and inspired another congregation.
Grounded in life, grounded in the realities of life, grounded in the great things of life, grounded in the difficult things of life, and walking through those with our choice of love. There is no test tube experiment that proves love is the right thing. It's when we choose it, it becomes our right thing. And we choose it in all the diverse and various ways we do that. And we pull on each other for wisdom. And that can come from someone who wrote something 3,000 years ago and someone that said something to you 5 minutes ago. It can all be incorporated into your growing wisdom of how to live grounded in life with love.
We've got a couple of readings. First one's from Romeo LeBlanc. We owe the Aboriginal peoples a debt that is now 4 centuries old. It is their turn to become full partners in developing an even greater Canada. And the reconciliation required may be less a matter of legal texts than of attitudes of the heart, offered as wisdom for the journey. Second, reconciliation means more than just a restoration of our relationship. Our women, our people, have unaddressed grief, intergenerational trauma, as the residential schools severed the most important bond. That bond between Indigenous children and their mothers and their families. This system exposed our children to a cycle of violence that continues to this day. But we know that violence is a learned behavior, and therefore, we also know that we can unlearn this behavior. We can make a change. Offered as wisdom for the journey.
For many years, the tune that our next song is being sung to had words to it, the purpose of which was to remove any semblance, any memory of Native spirituality and the gods that they understood and replace them with the God of Christianity. And so a few years ago, I rewrote it so that we could hold the hauntingness of the tune as a reminder of that. But speak about our oneness as human beings.
The main elements of this service are taken from the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The opening section is from the preface to the report, and the sections we will read later as the perspectives are from the introduction to that report. Canada's residential school system for Aboriginal children was an education system in name only for much of its existence. These residential schools were created for the purpose of separating Aboriginal children from their families in order to minimize and weaken family ties and cultural linkages and to indoctrinate children into a new culture, the culture of the legally dominant Euro-Christian Canadian society led by Canada's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The schools were in existence for well over 100 years, and many successive generations of children from the same communities and families endured the experience of those. That experience was hidden from most of the Canada's history until the survivors of that system were finally able to find the strength and courage and support to bring their experiences to light in several thousand court cases that ultimately led to the largest class action lawsuit in Canada's history.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada was a commission like no other in Canada, constituted and created by the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement, which settled the class actions. The commission spent 6 years traveling to all parts of Canada to hear from the Aboriginal people who had been taken from their families as children, forcibly, if necessary, and placed for much of their childhoods in residential schools. The commission heard from more than 6,000 witnesses, most of whom survived the experience of living in the schools as students. The stories of that experience are sometimes difficult to accept as something that could have happened in a country such as Canada, which has long prided itself on being a bastion of democracy, peace, and kindness throughout the world.
Children were abused physically and sexually, and they died in the schools in numbers that would not have been tolerated in any school system anywhere in this country or in the world. But shaming and pointing out wrongdoing were not the purpose of the Commission's mandate. Ultimately, the Commission's focus on truth determination was intended to lay the foundation for the important question of reconciliation. Now that we know about the residential schools and their legacy, what do we do about it? Getting to the truth was hard, but getting to reconciliation will be harder. It requires that the paternalistic and racist foundations of the residential school system be rejected as the basis for an ongoing relationship. Reconciliation requires that a new vision based on a commitment to mutual respect be developed. It also requires an understanding that the most harmful impacts of residential schools have been the loss of pride and self-respect of Aboriginal people, and the lack of respect that non-Aboriginal people have been raised to have for their Aboriginal neighbors. Reconciliation is not an Aboriginal problem. It is a Canadian one. Virtually all aspects of Canadian society may need to be reconsidered. Reconciliation will take some time.
The rest of our readings are from the introduction to the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. For over a century, the central goals of Canada's Aboriginal policy were to eliminate Aboriginal governments, ignore Aboriginal rights, terminate the treaties, and through a process of assimilation, cause Aboriginal peoples to cease to exist as distinct legal, social, cultural, religious, and racial entities in Canada. The establishment and operation of residential schools were a central element of this policy, which can best be described as cultural genocide. Physical genocide is the mass killing of the members of a targeted group, and biological genocide is the destruction of a group's reproductive capacity. Cultural genocide is the destruction of those structures and practices that allow the group to continue as a group. States that engage in cultural genocide set out to destroy the political and social institutions of the targeted group. Land is seized, and populations are forcibly transferred, and their movement is restricted. Languages are banned. Spiritual leaders are persecuted. Spiritual practices are forbidden, and objects of spiritual value are confiscated and destroyed. And most significantly to the issue at hand, families are disrupted to prevent the transmission of cultural values and identity from one generation to the next. In its dealings with Aboriginal peoples, Canada did all these things.
Canada asserted control over Aboriginal land. In some locations, Canada negotiated treaties with First Nations. In others, the land was simply occupied or seized. The negotiation of treaties, while seemingly honorable and legal, was often marked by fraud and coercion, and Canada was, and remains, slow to implement those provisions and intent. On occasion, Canada forced First Nations to relocate their reserves from agriculturally valuable or resource-rich land onto remote or economically marginal reserves. Without legal authority or foundation, in 1980s, Canada instituted a pass system that was intended to confine First Nations people to their reserves. Canada replaced existing forms of Aboriginal government with relatively powerless band councils whose decisions it could override and whose leaders it could dispose. In the process, it disempowered Aboriginal women who had held significant influence and powerful roles in many First Nations, including the Mohawks, the Carrier, Tlingit, and Canada denied the right to participate fully in Canadian political, economic, and social life to those Aboriginal people who refused to abandon their Aboriginal identity. Canada outlawed Aboriginal spiritual practices, jailed Aboriginal spiritual leaders, and confiscated sacred objects. And Canada separated children from their parents, sending them to residential schools. This was done not to educate them, but primarily to break their link to their culture and identity. In justifying the government's residential school policy, Canada's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, told the House of Commons in 1883, "When the school is on the reserve, the child lives with its parents, who are savages. He is surrounded by savages. And though he may learn to read and write, his habits and training and mode of thought are Indian. He is simply a savage who can read and write. It has been strongly pressed on myself as the head of the department that Indian children should be withdrawn as much as possible from the parental influence. And the only way to do that would be to put them in a central training industrial schools where they will require the habits and modes of thought of white men."
These measures were part of a coherent policy to eliminate Aboriginal people as distinct peoples and to assimilate them into the Canadian mainstream against their will. Deputy Minister of Indian Affairs Duncan Campbell Scott outlined the goals of that policy in 1920 when he told a parliamentary committee that, quote, "Our object is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic." Close quote. These goals were reiterated in 1969 in the federal government's Statement on Indian Policy, more often referred to as the White Paper, which sought to end Indian status and terminate the treaties that the federal government had negotiated with First Nations. The Canadian government pursued this policy of cultural genocide because it wished to divest itself of its legal and financial obligations to Aboriginal people and gain control over their land and resources. If every Aboriginal person had been, quote, absorbed into the body politic, close quote, there would be no reserves, no treaties, and no Aboriginal rights.
Residential schooling quickly became a central element in the federal government's Aboriginal policy. When Canada was created as a country 150 years ago, Canadian churches were already operating a small number of boarding schools for Aboriginal people. As settlement moved westward in the 1870s, Roman Catholic and Protestant missionaries established missions and small boarding schools across the prairies, in the north, and in British Columbia. Most of these schools received small per-student grants from the federal government. In 1883, the federal government moved to establish three large residential schools for First Nation children in Western Canada. In the following years, the system grew dramatically. According to the Indian Affairs Annual Report of 1930, there were 80 residential schools in operation across the country. The Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement provided compensation to students who attended 139 residential schools and residences. The federal government has estimated that at least 150,000 First Nation, Métis, and Inuit students passed through this system. Roman Catholic, Anglican, United, Methodist, and Presbyterian churches were the major denominations involved in the administration of the residential school system. The government's partnership with the churches remained in place until 1969. And although most of the schools had closed by the 1980s, the last federally supported residential school remained in operation until the 1990s.
For children, life in these schools was lonely and alien. Buildings were poorly located, poorly built, and poorly maintained. The staff was limited in numbers, often poorly trained, and not adequately supervised. Many schools were poorly heated and poorly ventilated, and the diet was meager and of poor quality. Discipline was harsh, and daily life was highly regimented. Aboriginal languages and cultures were denigrated and suppressed. The educational goals of the schools were limited and confused, and usually reflected a low regard for the intellectual capabilities of Aboriginal people. For the students, education and technical training too often gave way to the drudgery of doing the chores necessary to make the schools self-sustaining. Child neglect was institutionalized, and the lack of supervision created situations where students were prey to sexual and physical abusers.
In establishing residential schools, the Canadian government essentially declared Aboriginal people to be unfit parents. Aboriginal parents were labeled as being indifferent to the future of their children, a judgment contradicted by the fact that parents often kept their children out of schools because they saw those schools quite accurately as dangerous and harsh institutions that sought to raise their children in alien ways. Once in the schools, brothers and sisters were kept apart, and the government and churches even arranged marriages for students after they finished their education.
The residential school system was based on an assumption that European civilization and Christian religions were superior to Aboriginal culture, which was seen as being savage and brutal. Government officials also were insistent that children be discouraged and often prohibited from speaking their own languages. The missionaries who ran the schools played prominent roles in the church-led campaigns to ban Aboriginal spiritual practices, such as the potlatch and the sun dance, more properly called the thirst dance, and to end traditional Aboriginal marriage practices. Although in most of their official pronouncements, government and church officials took the position that Aboriginal people could be civilized, it is clear that many believed that Aboriginal culture was inherently inferior.
This hostility to Aboriginal cultural and spiritual practice continued well into the 20th century. In 1942, John House, the principal of the Anglican school in Glycon, Alberta, became involved in a campaign to have two Blackfoot chiefs deposed, in part because of their support for traditional dance ceremonies. In 1947, Roman Catholic official J.O. Plourd told a federal parliamentary committee that since Canada was a Christian nation that was committed to having all its citizens belonging to one or other of the Christian churches, quote unquote, he could see no reason why the residential schools should foster Aboriginal beliefs, quote unquote. United Church official George Dory told the same committee that he questioned whether there was even such a thing as native religion. In the 1950s and 60s, the prime mission of residential schools was the cultural transformation of Aboriginal children. In 1953, J.E. Andrews, the principal of the Presbyterian Church or Presbyterian School in Kenora, Ontario, wrote that, quote, "We must face realistically the fact that the only hope for the Canadian Indian is eventual assimilation into the white race," unquote. In 1957, the principal of the Gordons Reserve School in Saskatchewan, Albert Southard, wrote that he believed that the goal of residential schooling was, quote, "to change the philosophy of the Indian child. In other words, since they must work and live with whites, then they must begin to think as whites," unquote. Southard said that Gordon's school could never have a student council since, in quote, "insofar as the Indian understands the department's policy, he is against it," unquote. In a 1958 article on residential schools, senior Oblate André Renaud echoed the words of John A. MacDonald, arguing that when students at day schools went back to their homes, quote, at the end of the school day and for the weekend, the pupils are re-exposed to their native culture, however diluted, from which the school is trying to separate them.
Despite the coercive measures that the government adopted, it failed to achieve its policy goals. Although Aboriginal peoples and cultures have been badly damaged, they continue to exist. Aboriginal people have refused to surrender their identity. It was the former students, the survivors of Canada's residential schools, who placed the residential school on the public agenda. Their efforts led to the negotiation of the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement that mandated the establishment of a Residential School Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. The survivors acted with courage and determination. We should do no less. It is time to commit to a process of reconciliation. By establishing a new and respectful relationship, we restore what must be restored, repair what must be repaired, and return what must be returned.
To some people, reconciliation is the reestablishment of a conciliatory state. However, this is a state that many Aboriginal people assert never ever existed between the Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. To others, reconciliation in the context of Indian residential schools is similar to dealing with a situation of family violence. It's about coming to terms with events of the past in a manner that overcomes conflict and establishes a respectful and healthy relationship among people going forward. It is the latter context that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada has approached the question of reconciliation. To the Commission, reconciliation is about establishing and maintaining a mutually respectful relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples in this country. In order for that to happen, there has to be awareness of the past, acknowledgement of the harm that has been inflicted, atonement for the causes, and action to change behavior.
We are not there yet. The relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples is not a mutually respectful one. But we believe we can get there, and we believe that we can maintain it. Our ambition is to show how we can do that.
In 2015, as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada wraps up its work, the country has a chance for reconciliation. We live in a 21st century global world. At stake is Canada's place as a prosperous, just, and inclusive democracy within that global world. At the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's First Nation event in Winnipeg, Manitoba in 2010, residential school survivor Alma Manscott said, "The healing is happening, the reconciliation. I feel that there's some hope for us, not just as Canadians, but for the world. Because I know I'm not the only one. I know that Anishinaabe people across Canada, First Nations, are not the only ones. My brothers and sisters in New Zealand, Australia, Ireland. There's different areas of the world where this type of stuff happened. I don't see it happening in a year, but we can start making changes to laws and to education systems so that we can move forward. Reconciliation must support Aboriginal peoples as they heal from the destructive legacies of colonization that have wreaked havoc in their lives. It must do even more. Reconciliation must inspire Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples to transform Canadian society so that our children and grandchildren can live together in dignity, peace, and prosperity on these lands we now share."
The urgent need for reconciliation runs deep in Canada. Expanding public dialogue and action on reconciliation beyond residential schools will be critical in the coming years. Although some progress has been made, significant barriers to reconciliation remain. The relationship between the federal government and Aboriginal peoples is deteriorating. Instead of moving towards reconciliation, there have been divisive conflicts over Aboriginal education, child welfare, and justice. The Daily News has been filled with reports of controversial issues ranging from the call for a national inquiry on violence towards Aboriginal women and girls to the impact of the economic development of lands and resources on treaties and Aboriginal titles and rights. The courts continue to hear Aboriginal rights cases, and new litigation has been led by survivors of day schools not covered under the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement, as well as by victims of the 60s SCOOP, which was a child welfare policy that removed Aboriginal children from their homes and placed them with non-Aboriginal families. The promise of reconciliation, which seemed so imminent back in 2008 when the Prime Minister, on behalf of all Canadians, apologized to survivors, has faded.
Too many Canadians know little or nothing about the deep historical roots of these conflicts. This lack of historical knowledge has serious consequences for First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples, and for Canada as a whole. In government circles, it makes for poor public policy decisions. In the public realm, it reinforces racist attitudes and fuels civil distrust between Aboriginal peoples and other Canadians. Too many Canadians still do not know the history of Aboriginal peoples' contributions to Canada, or understand that by virtue of this historical and modern treaties negotiated by our government, we are all treaty people. History plays an important role in reconciliation to build for the future. Canadians must look to and learn from the past.
As commissioners, we understood from the start that although reconciliation could not be achieved during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's lifetime, the country could and must take ongoing positive and concrete steps forward. While the commission has been a catalyst for deepening our national awareness of the meaning and potential of reconciliation, it will take many heads, hands, and hearts working together at all levels of society to maintain momentum in the years ahead. It will also take sustained political will at all levels of government and concerted material resources.
The thousands of survivors who publicly shared their residential school experiences at Truth and Reconciliation Commission events in every region of this country have launched a much-needed dialogue about what is necessary to heal themselves, their families, communities, and the nation. Canadians have much to benefit from listening to these voices. Experiences and wisdom of survivors, elders, and traditional knowledge keepers. And much more to learn about reconciliation process itself. Aboriginal peoples have an important contribution to make to reconciliation. Their knowledge systems, oral histories, laws, and connections to the land have vitally informed the reconciliation process to date and are essential to its ongoing processes.
We conclude with a quote from the Reverend, very Reverend, Stan McKay of the United Church, former moderator, who is also a survivor and believes that reconciliation can happen only when everyone accepts responsibility for healing in ways that foster respect. He said, "There must be a change in perspective about the way in which Aboriginal peoples would be engaged with Canadian society in the quest for reconciliation. We cannot perpetuate the paternalistic concept that only Aboriginal peoples are in need of healing. The perpetrators are wounded and marked by history in ways that are different from the victims, but both groups require healing. How can a conversation about reconciliation take place if all involved do not adopt an attitude of humility and respect? We all have stories to tell, and in order to grow in tolerance and understanding, we must listen to the stories of others." I'm going to invite Gary Wasikizik to come forward to respond to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report and give some thoughts on reconciliation that he has to share. Gary's gift is that he has a voice and he has the courage to use it. He has eyes that will look into ours, that will call us to account, and that will challenge us to be who we are in relationship with Him, and to become better in that relationship. Gary hopes to come in another few weeks to come back and share his story more fully, because he has much that he can offer us.
My name is Gary Wasikizik. Everything that you've heard this morning, these people have talked about, I was directly impacted, indirectly impacted, directly impacted. I went through two residential schools myself. The separation of mother and child I experienced. I tell my story today. You can Google Gary Wasikizik. I've been pretty active. I know all about the missing murdered Native women's issue. I got active, say about 12 years ago, longer now, because of the missing murdered Native women's issues. My mother was murdered while I was in a residential school. One of the things that I'd like to point out is for you to realize, like I said, these people talked about, you know, the history of residential schools and our history with, you know, colonization. What you people call colonization, see, when you talk about colonization, what you call colonization, assimilation, and education, we call genocide and crimes against humanity. You want to talk reconciliation? Well, bring back my mother. Bring back my father. My grandmother. My family. They were all murdered. They were all died mysteriously. See, why I'm trying to bring this fact out is I have 10 minutes to try to tell you something. It took a lifetime for me to get here to talk to you, and I have to tell you in 10 minutes. But one of the policies of the school, everybody points to the Catholic Church, the United Church, the Anglican Church, as the main culprits of the residential school system. But also, little is known about the Mennonites that created schools. Government played a large, big part in those policies and laws and rules that were made for our people, enforced on our people. I remember being told about my mother way after the fact. She had been buried, gone, about a year. Then you're put into this room. You're told you want, principal wants to see you. So, I know something's wrong. I'm supposed to go see the principal at night, him and his wife. That's when I'm being informed of my mother. At that time, I'm a kid. I'm being informed. I go into shock. You break that separation. You go into trauma. Like I said, you can Google all this story. But I want to bring out this policy. The policy not to inform the child of a passing of a parent, whether it's your grandmother, whether it's your grandfather, whether it's your grandmother, whether it's your father, whether it's your mother, whether it's your siblings. I remember that moment when I'm being informed. The shock, the trauma starts setting in, which would set the stage for what was supposed to come later on in life. The jails, the foster homes. I can't go home no more. I'm in a residential school. I just been informed. So they put me in another home. And that's the story of the First Nations people across the country. I thought I was like on my own. But when I got active, started looking into my mother's case, I started finding out about policies, laws, rules that were made for our people. And I fell into all those traps that they set. The person that you see on the street today, the First Nations people that you see on the street today, they're not there just because they like to drink, they like to do drugs, or they like to be homeless. How can a First Nations people, any First Nations people in this country, be homeless? There should not be one First Nations people in this country homeless. Canada prides itself on being a financial superpower on the world stage. They brag about it. We live it. I take shame in that, living in Toronto. Indian pain is big business. Where do you think Canada gets its mineral from? Where do you think it gets its oil from? Where do you think it gets its trees from? Those are our trap lines, our hunting grounds. We've been roaming for 20,000 years and longer. We learned to live in a cycle. We are not the savages that everybody talks about. I have to ask this question now. When you have global warming, when you have climate change, when you have so much violence in the street, now you have ISIS, now you have, who's the savage now? We used to learn to live with the environment. We lived in a cycle. We lived in teepees. Hollywood made fun of. We lived in a cycle. That's what a teepee was. We could have built bridges. We could have built buildings. We could have built just like anybody else. So why do they treat us different? We bleed. We cry. How come they don't? So why do they do genocide on us? I have proof of genocide. To this day, it carries on. I have story after story now of where Native Child, CAS, is still carrying on this practice that the government hands out, the laws, the rules, the policies. We have more kids in care now than ever. Now, as an activist, I hear story after story, night after night, where Native Child in Toronto, CAS in Toronto, raids homes of young mothers and snatches their kids. They wait in hospital rooms, corridors, waiting for the young to give birth so that they can take the child. I had one incident last week I could have talked about here. I wanted to talk about, but again, the crime. We only have 10 minutes. We only have 1 minute to hear your story. I have a story I want to tell of how a CAS dropped a Native child on its head in a courtroom where they were trying to take the child from the mother. How I got this story is because I have concerned Native women in the community who go to these snatchings and try to defend the young mother. That's night after night while you're sitting at Tim Hortons, while you're going to McDonald's, while you're watching TV. Our story, our genocide, our crimes against humanity is still going on to this day. I have 10 minutes. I can talk all afternoon. I've done blockades. I've done road blockades. I've done train blockades. I don't drink. I haven't drank for 30 years now. Over 30 years. I don't do drugs. I'm not into the drug scene. I'm into getting the word out as to what really happened with our people. Reconciliation. When they talk about reconciliation, how do you reconcile with your abuser? How do you come to terms with the one that who has abused you? Like I said, if you want to talk about reconciliation, ask me, ask my friends, ask my relatives. You guys want to talk reconciliation? All you hear it is from the politicians. You're not getting. I know. I got people talk about reconciliation. forgive? I'll never forgive. I have that statement from one person, and I have that statement from people. I'll never forgive what they did. Because, you know, this country has a habit of taking off to what? Where is it? Where's the latest catastrophe? The earthquakes? The tsunamis? Canada. You know, just start looking in your own backyard. I'm insulted when I hear, when I come to these places, I've talked at universities, I've talked at demonstrations, rallies. Like I said, I've done train blockades, road blockades. I've talked in courts where I've been charged. Line 9, pipelines. You know, I said I'm insulted when I hear the words reconciliation. And I'm insulted when I hear people want to help people from other countries, relocate them here, bring them to a better life. Look in your own backyard. How come you're not sponsoring one of our First Nations families who's living in third world conditions, who's trying to survive suicide amongst the youth, who's trying to survive the crisis that we have with our, what do you call it, the high blood, anyways, like I said, there's a real crisis with our, with the youth, the suicide crisis. We have so much epidemics happening, different forms, that, like I said, we're in third world condition. Recently, the latest action that I did was going into Queen's Park. I don't know if anybody's seen the articles. We took over Queen's Park. Well, we didn't take over Queen's Park, but we took over. We set up camp in Queen's Park to because this my friend Devine wanted to do a fast to bring light to some of the causes that we have across Turtle Island, which you call Canada. This article in the Toronto paper talks about how Devine did a 13-day fast. But like I said, myself, I don't like doing them, but it's become a responsibility. I've taken it upon myself to talk for others that can't be here, the ones that have passed. And I speak for the ones that are here, because quite a few people do not know what happened to First Nations people. But anyways, I said with what we did in the park was trying to bring that awareness of the issues that we face. Like I said, in Thunder Bay, there's a real crisis happening with our people right now. I've been on the streets in Thunder Bay. My relatives have moved to Thunder Bay. I recently I had two younger brothers who have died in Thunder Bay. I've just buried them recently. There's kids that are ending up in the river in Thunder Bay. I recommend very strongly that you start Googling Thunder Bay, checking out Thunder Bay, and supporting Thunder Bay, and getting active in Thunder Bay. You want to talk about you want to talk about reconciliation? You know, I recommend you check out Thunder Bay. Whether it's newspaper, internet, whatever it means that you have. But I do recommend you check Thunder Bay out. And like I said, we got to talk about missing murdered Native women at the park. We went into the park without permit. We went into the park without any proper authorization. We went in there as claiming our right to be there as First Nations people who have roamed on this ground for 20,000 years. We tried this act before. We tried to light a sacred fire in Queen's Park before. And the first time, like I said, I face off with police, permit, whoever. I have to face off with politicians. And the first time I went in there, they removed us kind of like physically. You know, you have to watch out for permit, bylaw officers. Then they call the fire department. And then when that doesn't work, they send in the police. So you have to what? Boom, 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 boom. Then you're facing off with a whole lot of police in the bottom line. Second time we went in, again, boom. You have to waiting for that. By this time you're a little you know a little bit what you're getting into. So, okay, here they come. Here's the bylaw officer. Here comes the fire department. Here comes the police. Again, we're getting removed. So, but you know what? This time, we wanted to talk about our issues. Devine wanted to do a 13-day fast, which is very sacred in our culture, which is one of the practices that they took. We went in there, set up camp, we flew the flags, we set up our tent, and we lit the sacred fire. And then when they came at us again, I had to step out again, talk to them. This time, yeah, we talked about the fire, we talked about the tent, but this time, we talked about reconciliation. Well, if you guys want to reconcile, and, you know, Justin Trudeau, all over the news about reconciliation, well, why don't you let us light our sacred fire? Why not let my friend Devine Calfchild do his 13-day fast in honor of missing murdered Native women, in honor of missing murdered Native men, which is on the rise, in honor of Thunder Bay, in honor of the residential school system that was in place, the 60 scoop, and other issues that we face, the water crisis, the epidemics that we have. This time, this time around, you know, when you're facing off, this is high wire. This is like tension, you know, like you're facing off with the authorities that be. And boom, this time around, they talked about it. And instead of physically removing us, they talked about it. And then they backed off. And that's what I recommend. Me as a hardcore activist, that is what I want to see. You want to talk about reconciliation? Don't go to the politician. Don't go to, you know, our politicians. There's a whole lot of infighting which was created on purpose. The policies, the laws, the rules that were made for our people are in play today. The infighting that goes on within First Nations. Take it from me. I am a survivor of that system. I do not call myself an activist. I do not call myself a fighter. I do not call myself... I just like to call myself someone who has woken up. They put us to sleep. They put me to sleep by putting me through the system up to the point of where I can't even fight no more. I can't even talk no more. And they also put you to sleep. Because Canada has never stopped the war against First Nations. The propaganda is still at play today. And he said, you know, hopefully, you know, with this 10-minute talk, probably over now. but anyways, like I said, hopefully people start waking up to the real story of First Nations people. There is so much to talk about. There's so many things to point out. There's so many things. Like I said, Thunder Bay, I have so much documents to show, and hopefully I can return. And next time, I will bring more people that will give you full, you know, the full story, the real story of what happened with our people. But I thank you for this moment, and I thank you for the time. I thank you for that awareness. And like I said, I recommend that that you check Thunder Bay. And one of the reasons that I made it a point to be here today. I wanted to be here today. Because, like I said, I speak for people that are not able to be here. And when I hear of places like this, this is what reconciliation is all about. Miigwech, miigwech, miigwech.
Gary. Thank you. Gary, I'm going to ask Frank to get the bikers down at Parliament to help with that. And I'm going to invite you to stand, if you would, put your papers away and stand at the end of our table and let me tell you about what our table is about. Because I think that it is important that we hear exactly what it is that we have to do. And it's important that we hear it from our Indigenous brothers and sisters. Because we are infuriated by what our forebears have done. And we are ashamed of how that legacy lives itself out in our communities and in our country. And we need to end that. So our significant symbolic movement today, you'll see the table in the center, and there's one row. And that symbolizes the row, your row, of the two-row wampum. And lying on it are ribbons that have the reconciliation recommendations on them. And I'm, yeah, sure. Sorry.
This two-row that you have on the table that she talks about, the two-row represents the treaty that we have, we supposedly had with the people that came here in the beginning of time. But anyways, the two-row is supposed to signify the walking together. But when you say the two-row is our row, it's not our row no more. One has jumped over to our and dominated. So it's become more or less,
well, that's what I want to do. What I was, yeah. I've symbolized it by saying we haven't even walked. Yeah. That our side is completely empty because we haven't walked with you at all. And so what I'm going to ask you to do is stand at the head of the table as members of the congregation come and each of you take one of those ribbons and read what that recommendation says on it and ask yourself if you know anything about what that recommendation says. And I would be willing to bet that most of you have no idea. And once you've read it, and I don't need you to read it out loud, just read it to yourself, place it along the other side as your commitment to help this community and people beyond it to find ways to walk that two row together, because that's what we have to do. And the recommendations came out of a process, but the commission in 1996 came out of a process and ended up on a shelf in Ottawa just getting dust. We cannot let this grow dust. We have to live it out. And so I want you to bear witness to what it is that we do and the commitment that we make by moving these recommendations one by one into our side and our accountability, and we take action on them. So I invite you, we're going to sing as we're doing that. Those of you who are not up at the moment are going to sing, "O Love That Wilt Not Let Me Go." And there's a verse in here that I wrote for John Trudell, who is one of my heroes, one of the leaders of the American Indian Movement who helped take Alcatraz, and I would love to watch you take Parliament. He helped take Alcatraz, and he led the American Indian Movement with a courage and a bravery and with an obstinance and a challenge to the government that had never been seen before, and he brought people together in an incredible way until his heart and his spirit were broken. And he couldn't do that work anymore, so he handed it off to others and created a beauty through music and the arts until he died recently. But the verse about, "O earth that holds my people's tears," that verse was written for him and for the gift that he has given us. So if I'll come and stand with you, and then we'll sing the song and people can start the process of moving those recommendations over.
Let me go.
touching. Gary, thank you for sharing your words with us and for giving us a glimpse into the depths of the tragedy that you have lived through, you and your family and your people have lived through. This was a really touching ceremony, and now in the end we have two rows. Look at that. Each week, this is going to bring tears to my eyes. So, Gary, for almost 2 years we've been doing this, reading one of the recommendations from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Each week, in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationship we have with our First Nations sisters and brothers, we read one of the 94 recommendations to all sent to all levels of government by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Today marks the last day that we will do this. And today you are invited to read the recommendation with me. It is a suggested new oath of citizenship to be made by new Canadians or continuing Canadians, which recognizes the individual's responsibilities as a treaty participant. Please stand as you are able and read along with me recommendation number 4 as I read it off of the last purple ribbon. We call upon the Government of Canada to replace the oath of citizenship with the following. I swear or affirm, please join in, that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Canada, her heirs and successors, and that I will faithfully observe the laws of Canada, including treaties with Indigenous peoples, and fulfill my duties as a Canadian citizen. It is our fervent hope that our own Zeb may someday, at her citizenship ceremony, get to read exactly that. In this, our time of need,
every time we get ready to leave this place, the screen comes up that says watching each other away. And almost every week I tell you that you go out into a world that's broken, that there's so much tragedy and loss and destroyed relationship out there. And I call you to be light in that place. Amongst all those broken relationships, holding all the responsibility that is ours to bear, and walking in a way that creates beauty, that builds dignity, that sees in another's eyes what they have to offer us and what they have offered the world, and that invites them to see in our eyes what we may yet be. Go from this place. Go into the work of creating right relationship, and go with the challenge of being light in a broken world. Go in peace.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.